Right, we're going to get started here. My name is Rebecca Wolf. I'm an undergrad student at NYU and a member of the newly formed New York University Peace Coalition. We were formed, obviously, in response to what has happened on September 11th and since the repercussions of the United States government military and our position as students and as citizens. A little bit about our coalition. We have five fairly simple, straightforward points of unity. Our first one, obviously, is peace and a nonviolent resolution to world conflicts. A long-term goal and efforts to eradicate the socioeconomic situations that breed terrorism around the world, including in the United States, the preservation of our freedoms and civil liberties in times of war, as well as those of people around the world, as much as we can do, and a long-term commitment to education around the complexities of the issues that we are now faced with. We have only begun to realize the complexities of these issues, of the issue of war and peace, and our position as students within this entire system, especially as students at NYU. We have been doing a lot of coalition outreach to different groups all over the university as well as citywide around these issues. But we would like to welcome you to join us in this process of trying to figure out and dissect these ideas of peace and these ideas of activism within that world. So with that said, our first speaker is Todd Ensign. He's the director of Citizen Soldier, which is a GI and veterans advocacy group, which was founded in 1969. He's the author of GI Guinea Pigs and Military Life, an Insider's Guide. He's worked with war resistors and conscientious objectors since the Vietnam War. He is also a lawyer. And is now working particularly with thousands and thousands of soldiers who were sent into the Middle East who have Gulf War syndrome. Please welcome him.
Thank you. Well, reminded of 30 years ago, we were in this building that next door they tore down, Loeb Center, many times in that period of the Vietnam War. And I'll leave you just with one thing to consider about that, was that back in 65, when the Marines went into Da Nang, you remember, that's when we decided to really become involved to begin to displace the Vietnamese as a ground force. It was kind of, in some ways, of course, history never repeats itself, but in some ways there's some strong parallels to now. By that I mean that we thought then, we didn't really have any real conception of what they, meaning the Pentagon, had in mind. We had no idea about programs like Agent Orange, the massive bombing, which later became, you know, a feature of the war. And so I think it's wonderful that you've turned out tonight, because you can be sure with a budget of $330 billion a year that they are very, very assiduously working on a plan and plans to move this enterprise ahead. And what we see right now, like the proverbial camel's nose in the tent, we see just a small part of it. And of course, as you realize, anyone can see Bush on TV, and the dissembling is so obvious, and the attempt to present a facade is apparent, really, to anyone who looks. And so I'm going to sketch out a bit about the Gulf War, because I think it's very, very apropos, and then turn to what I see as a likely phased escalation of this war against, quote, terrorism, Enduring Freedom, Operation Enduring Freedom. It may take on other names as it goes forward. So just 5 minutes about the Gulf War, because it's very important. And the reason for that is that not much has really changed in terms of our doctrinal and our tactical response to the problems there. What are those problems? Well, you probably all realize, for one thing, we didn't know how to detect biological or chemical weapons there. And you might recall, some of you that have read much about it, that the pesky Czechs went over there, and you know they were just out from under the Russian domination, so they were eager to get involved and play a role. This is 91. And Havel and the others sent these Czech detection units over there. And, you know, the Russians are actually, Soviet forces were masters at chemical biological weapons. And I'll talk about another aspect of that in a minute. And so the Czechs went over there with their detection gear and their Fox vehicles, and they were driving all around in the Gulf, and they immediately started finding positive signs of biological or chemical weapons. And you may, some of you may recall this, and my God, the Americans didn't know what to say to this. And the Czechs were saying, you know, sir, it's very strange, but out there on that battlefield, we're finding this level, we're finding that level. All our alarms are being activated. And, of course, Norman and the others said, no, it can't be. It's not possible. And the fact, of course, is that we didn't really have even what the Czechs had in terms of detection. And so many, many troops, many of our own troops were exposed when they went out, particularly and detonated these chemical weapons dumps. It's one of the scandals of that war. The Kamsea alone probably exposed 10 or 12,000 troops. It's just outrageous what was done. And then, of course, for 3 or 4 years, they sat on it. Finally, about 4 years later, in 95, 96, the CIA said, well, you know, we've done some modeling, some computer modeling, and we actually it's possible that that did have, why, well, the winds could have gone this way. You know, and they finally acknowledged and admitted. And then eventually the VA was dragged into it. And they said, well, all right, if you can show you're a Kamsea, we'll look differently at your disability claim. So that's the one problem. Another problem, of course, you know, was depleted uranium. This was the first time we ever used depleted uranium. And that's a radioactive tip to a shell. It's used on tanks, planes, and artillery. And this thing, this stuff, is about 60% of the natural radiation of uranium. So they call it depleted. Sounds good. Sounds like, gee, that's all right. It's not depleted. It's reduced, would be a much better adjective. Reduced uranium weapon, but it's depleted uranium weapon. All right. So the DU weapons, you can be sure, these, you read stories in the paper the last couple of days, the bunker busters, those are completely DU bombs. DU is very peripheric. In other words, it penetrates any surface, and it creates a fire within it, knocks out. That's why we were able to knock out about 1,200 Iraqi tanks and armored cars with no losses, because we'd penetrate the car, and that was the end of it. It would just go up and be consumed. And the problem with this stuff is that it's radioactive dust. And many of our own troops, not to mention the Iraqis, many of our own troops were on these tanks, on these cars afterwards, taking souvenirs, moving around in these areas, dust littered throughout the desert there. And, of course, to this day, we've done absolutely no cleanup. I did bring along a brochure that we published just recently. I've got a lot of them, so everyone should be able to have one. It kind of goes over the questions of DU. And what I think it shows is that the Pentagon, even today with a lip service it makes about troops and we've got to take care of our people, and the Agent Orange thing will never happen again, and the atomic vets, they'll never be exposed like that again. In fact, when you look at the history and you read, I think, some of the data in here, you'll see that that's not true. These weapons are deadly, they're very effective, and the Pentagon has absolutely no intention of giving them up. And at the same time, they don't even train our troops into how to at least reduce the risk. And so that's another thing we can look for in the near term. The other area, of course, is vaccines. Papers the last few days filled with stuff about anthrax, just filled. And yet, when they wanted to develop a vaccine for the soldiers, for our own people, forget, as I say, forget the Iraqis or the Kuwaitis or anyone else that was there. That wasn't a concern. When they went to do that, what did they do? They went back to a 1970 vaccine that was developed to use with animal hide workers, people that cut, you know, strip basically skin cattle. And this anthrax vaccine is for skin contact, exposure directly to the skin. And this was a very limited study was done actually to get it approved, but it was approved. The FDA approved it. So that's the vaccine they're going to use. Well, you don't have to be a military strategist to realize, well, wait a minute. Is that how an anthrax weapon would work? You got skins laying on the ground, soldiers will get down, pick them up, and they get... No, that wasn't exactly how it's going to work. And it was well known that it's inhalation, which is what you're reading in the paper today, and yesterday, and probably tomorrow. Inhalation is a very different vehicle for exposure than skin. And what we did was, the military did not want to get involved in the whole... peer review process, scrutiny, scientific review of another vaccine. So they say, hey, this one here, a cattle, that's all right, we'll take that, down off the shelf. And that's what they started giving troops. And one of the heartening things about this, I hope you'll take some heart from this, is that thousands of young troops, 19 people your age and even younger, 19, 20-year-old kids said, What is in this stuff? What's this for? What will this do to my reproductive future? What will this do? What will the adverse reactions be? And tens of thousands of people said, I'm not taking this stuff. They're in uniform. I'm not talking reservists. I'm talking about people in uniform. The Marines are a center of this opposition. Marine Corps in Japan, hundreds of them said, I'm not taking it. So I take a certain, I don't want to oversell it, but I take a certain heart in that, that people today, unlike my generation, the Vietnam War, I remember working on construction jobs when I was in college, and a lot of guys didn't wear the helmets. I don't need no helmet. That helmet's for sissies. That, you know, that kind of attitude. Today, you don't see that, and that's a very healthy change. Young people today realize these toxic chemicals have long-term health effects. You can't always tell, and you aren't always sure. And so anyway, what we did as Citizen Soldier and other groups too was we fed them with information using the internet and other ways, and we were able to get really thousands of people to stand up to this. And actually what happened was, you probably know, is the whole program collapsed because the lab that was making it could never really satisfy the FDA about its own production. Leave aside whether it would protect anybody. Then in the middle of this, there's another guy in the press right today, this guy Ken Alibek. And he had some really scary things to say. You might know this name. He's a Kazakhstani who worked for Biopreparat. And Biopreparat is the Soviet lab which was in Sverdlovsk, which has now been renamed something else. I can't keep it straight. But under the Soviet Union, it was called Sverdlovsk. And in 1979, someone left the cookers on a little too high one night. Maybe they were making some tacos in the cookers like they did up at the lab in Lansing. And the thing went up. And about 80 people died. So take heart from that. Here's a town of 100,000 people, and only 80 people died from a full-scale venting of anthrax. So what's that say? It says that anthrax, it's not so easy to poison people with anthrax, which is a good thing in general. Us residents of New York City, we like that. But what they found when they went to these cadavers was that they had several different strains of anthrax bacillus in them. So the Russians, not stupid, were saying, hey, wait, we got recombinant DNA. Let's see what we could do with this bacteria. We'll make some other kinds of bacteria. Well, back at Fort Detrick, our great army scientists, you know, our colonels and generals, they're there with the old cow skin, the old bacteria from the 60s, and that's what they're vaccinating people for. Okay, so we got four types just in this very last people. God knows how many other types there are. And that was 1979, so imagine 21 more years of DNA research. Who the hell knows? So the point of it all is, you probably can't vaccinate people. You probably can't. And if you notice in all the pages and pages in the New York Times and Washington Post, there's not any mention right now about this vaccine thing, if you notice. There's a sidebar story about how the vaccine lab has been a mess and they don't know what to do with it. But you don't see anyone saying, oh, line up and get a vaccine shot. Because they realize that you probably can. That's bad news. But hey, we need to know it. Let's not pretend. Let's not say, gee, you're okay now, soldier. You've got the anthrax vaccine in you. Go on out to that battlefield. They're going to set off some weapons out there. You'll be all right. You know, so that's a good thing. Again, it shows how today we can organize, we can get the word out, we can mobilize people. People are not stupid. They understand these things, at least in their general terms. The other thing about the Gulf War, and then I'll go on to the future, is that it was represented a new stage of control by the military in the Gulf. And I don't know if you remember this, some of you might. There's a pretty good book by a guy named John MacArthur, who wrote a book about, I don't know the title to it, but it's about the press and the muzzling of the press in the Gulf War. And you may remember this, maybe you don't, that even Walter Cronkite and some of those other guys went down and joined a lawsuit which tried to open up the whole Pentagon process. And what was happening was that they were not essentially giving out any information about what was going on, the bombings, the effects, all these other issues I've already raised. No discussion, nothing. You want to go out and talk to a couple soldiers? Well, you can go and talk to them, and we'll sit right there with you while you talk to them, and you ask them if they're homesick and if they're really ready for this mission, that kind of stuff. And that's what we got in the Gulf War. The other thing they did, which is even more significant from my point of view, is that they put unprecedented controls on soldiers. So they eliminated, you remember in the Vietnam War, soldiers would come back from the war and they would protest and they would speak out and they'd say, well, that's not true what they're saying. Well, I fought in that war. That war was genocidal. That war was this or that. That was very, very upsetting over the long term to our military. And they didn't allow that. So the rules were, no, there will be no ETSing. No one will get out of the Gulf War. So if that war had gone on for 2 years, you would have had no discharges. I mean, you come home in a box or maybe to a hospital, and that's it. The other thing they did was they completely stripped away the rights of people to file CO claims. You probably remember this. And people would file COs, and one of the things you're supposed to do with a CO claim is once you make the claim, they're supposed to assign you to something that doesn't, you know, any conflict with your stated beliefs anymore. It has to. They aren't supposed to hand you an M16 and say, okay, soldier, get out there and defend that perimeter. They're supposed to give you some other job. Well, they didn't do that at all. A lot of people were isolated. They sent them over. There were some terrible stories of abuse that I don't have time to go into. But the point we have is that, and that's the theme kind of citizen soldiers, this is our military. These are our citizens. They're citizens first. And they should not be treated in this kind of totally arbitrary and unconstitutional way. So that's the other part of the Gulf War, because they thought, we'll learn from Vietnam, we won't let a movement grow up of people criticizing what we're doing, or maybe the deaths or civilian deaths or anything like that. We just won't let it happen. So we'll see that again with this war, and you see it right now with the media. Well, partly they're helped because it's so remote and so difficult that there's very little media access anyway, as you know. So now I'd like to go to the question of what I see is the possible, maybe even probable, evolution here. We know that Bush has said this is going to be a long war. This is not going to end tomorrow. There's not going to be any easy. As Don Rumsfeld said, there'll be no signing on the battle on the deck of the Missouri. No surrender signing. No. Mm. Oh, really, Don? Okay. So that's what they're getting you ready for. Open-ended, real vague and indeterminate, long-term. And so who's going to define victory? Big question. All right. So here's how I see it. Let me just get a sip of water here. First phase will be what we're in now. That's air, heavy air. We're good at that. Oh, boy, we got those B-52s, man. They can fly all the way from Missouri, all the way over there without even... Well, they got to fuel up a little more, but no problem, man. Drop those 2,000 or 3,000 pound bombs, daisy cutters. I told you already about the bunker busters. You know, we got all these great names. Napalm, you'll see, start seeing anything we need. All right, so that's phase one. Lots of air insertion up high. Hope they don't get shot down by any of those stingers that we gave them back in the 70s. You know, if you stay below, I guess you stay above 12,000, 14,000 feet, a stinger probably can't hit you. And those B-52s, they fly 35,000, 40,000 feet up. But there's anti-aircraft batteries. Maybe who knows what else they got over there. And so you'll probably see before too long a few of these planes going down. Then the whole frenzy will be like it was in Yugoslavia. Remember, let's get that pilot back. We've got to get him back. And so the 1,000 people in Uzbekistan now are supposedly on guard just to get retrieval of pilots. That's their job right now, they say. Okay. Then you'll see commando raids. This is still in phase one. Some of you may have read, and the rest of you should take the time to read a book called Black Hawk Down. You might have heard of it. It's a bestseller. It's the best paperback bestseller right now by a guy named Mark Bowen, who is a reporter with the Philadelphia Inquirer. Black Hawk Down is about a four-day period in Mogadishu back in 93. And Mogadishu was, you know, a little bit, yeah, I wouldn't say it's, I'm no expert, but I don't think it's so hell of a lot different from Kandahar or Jalalabad or even Kabul. And anyway, this was a disaster. I won't go into it, but it was Delta Force leads the charge. These are guys whose training is so secret that when you go, as I've been to Fort Bragg a number of times on cases, you try to get a press officer at Fort Bragg. This isn't a democracy now. You try to get a press officer at Fort Bragg, you say, God, Captain, you've really been helpful here today. Do you think tomorrow afternoon we got a recess? Do you think maybe we could go out and take a look at some of that Delta Force training? Ooh, what training? I don't know it. No, I'm not clear to even talk about it. It's totally secret, classified. I'm not kidding you. You get out of Fort Bragg, check it out. So this guy in the book even says, you know, I could only analyze some of their tactics because I don't know about all of them. And I only got two of the people even talk to me. And they've been silenced by the others and ostracized. Okay, this is the Delta Force that's going to do this. I've laid out enough sarcasm here. But the point is, this stuff sounds good. And when Bruce Willis is rappelling down a helicopter rope, it looks great. you know, and the rippling muscles, and man, he's got the black all painted around his face. Man, it's great. But reality, different. Ask any Vietnam vet, they'll tell you that. Gulf War vet even, they'll tell you that. Reality is different. So that's going to be the other part of phase one. Commandos, inserting people, will capture, who is it? Well, we'll capture somebody. We'll take them out. We'll bring them out. We'll remember in Mogadishu, we're going to get ID, the warlord. We're going to get him. Well, they never even got close to ID. They never even found out where he was. And we lost 20 people. It was a disaster, as I said. This thing is going to make that look like a Sunday afternoon in Portion Square Park. Okay, so that's the phase one in my prediction. The second part will be phase two. They won't necessarily be, we will not be told we're going into the new phase. Oh, no. But it'll start to happen. So all of a sudden, the phase two is generally an expansion of these types of tactics into other parts of the region. You've already heard a little bit about this. He said, we'll go wherever we have to go. No one should feel they're safe. If they're doing anything, they can better be wary, because we will go wherever they are and take the battle to them. That's the kind of theme, right? All right. So phase two will be, all of a sudden, we'll be talking about we got to go into the Sudan. I wouldn't rule out going into South Lebanon. I wouldn't rule out parts of, like, Chechen. Sounds familiar. Well, Putin's going to get something for this, right? Putin, Prime Minister of Soviet Russia. He's going to get something. He's got a nasty problem in Chechen with these Muslims. And he's going to, you don't be surprised, or even in Uzbekistan, it's got their own problems. So you'll see commando raids then start to take place in other places. And they'll be in concert with our, quote, allies. And you know, you can imagine where that can lead. If our allies are the Israelis. If our allies are some other rump group in Sudan, or this National Alliance. You know, very interesting about the National Alliance. They talk about how the National Alliance, that's a, you know, an alternative to the Taliban. Well, there's a story just last week in one of the British papers, who do, as you know, a much better job of covering these things than we do here. And they had a story about how the National Alliance got into a serious contretemps with some UN observers because 200 Taliban tried to surrender to them, and they mowed them all down. Just mowed them down. So, you know, I mean, let's not have any illusions about who these folks are, who our allies are going to be. All right. So that's phase two, I think. God knows where that will lead. God knows how much mobilization, but still, we still will not have ground forces, conventional operations. There still will not be that. It'll be this idea. But before long, of course, that'll become a question. We can't hold this terrain. Commandos don't hold terrain. They don't. They go in, they take people, they knock out things, and they leave. So if you want to try to change the politics of a given area, you're going to have to do something else, which means conventional force. Now, the third part of it, and this is scary, but I don't think it's I don't think I'm being hyperbolic here. You keep seeing these references to Saddam, to Iraq. You know, back in 91, we just should have kept going on right up that road. We should have taken care of these folks. What's the word? I think Colin Powell used, or maybe one of the other generals. Take the head off the viper, something like that. Johnson said, we're going to nail the coonskin to the cabin wall. That was his. Well, let's just take the head off the viper. Okay, so that may be our third phase, will be a much larger, and that, of course, would require major conventional operations. You can't go into, and no matter what condition of the Iraqi military, you cannot go into a country of that size and begin to move around even if you're willing to take casualties, you'd have enormous problems. So we may be looking toward down the road, and this may be not in months, it may not even be in the next year, that kind of movement. Because if you think about, the logic follows. We got to knock out terrorism. We keep redefining who they are. We keep finding new elements of it. It's broader than we thought. Maybe it's not just Al-Qaeda. Maybe it's other. Maybe it's state-sponsored. And that shift takes place, and then we will be in a situation which all bets are off. And compared to Vietnam, remember Vietnam, the technology was much lower then. Troops went to Vietnam in boats. You know, they used to go to Vietnam in boats, take 2 weeks to get there. Not anymore. Weapons, vastly more powerful, vastly more dangerous, like I said, the depleted uranium, other weapons. So you've got a much more deadly, lethal environment. You've got all these chemicals in use. And so it's going to be, we could be looking towards something that's very, very fearful. And unlike really anything we've lived through, you can't look back to Vietnam or to the Gulf and say, oh, those are some precedent. How did that turn out? It may not really be. It may be of a whole different order of magnitude. And I'd say this to close, that this is where we need to place, you know, this should drive us forward. And we need to commit ourselves and draw on people. We've got to build this movement now. And the final point I'll make is that don't think ever that these soldiers, people that have volunteered, don't think and don't understand and don't draw the same conclusions that we do. They don't have the same information, and they're subjected to massive amounts of brainwashing, especially in the airborne and the marine units. They're really heavily brainwashed. But they are accessible to us in many ways, and we need to always keep those channels open, as lines open with them, support them. And I think over time we can hopefully stop this juggernaut.